Well, we have been saying that in order not to waste your life, you need to have some basic foundation stones in place. And a few weeks ago, I talked with us about learning to wait on the Lord, to wait for strength, to wait for some insight, for some direction, maybe some comfort sometimes, to learn to wait. Oh, no, that's a key foundation stone. Another was to learn to be honest with God, to practice spiritual breathing, Tim called it. To, if need be like the Psalms and yell and scream and pour out your complaint and wait for his response. And then last week, Tim was talking to us about the utter confidence we can have in the Scriptures, contrary to what you hear on some Luther college courses. We have heard about some of those. He talked about a young Bedouin sheep herder, actually goat herder, who found the Dead Sea Scrolls, happened to find the Dead Sea Scrolls. And these scrolls would be about 1,000 years or so older than the most recent copies of portions of the Old Testament that we had. And when we compared the two, they were virtually identical. And so we can have confidence that what God has passed down to, God has carefully passed down to us what he intended us to have. That should give us confidence in the Word. Today I want to address another foundation stone, and it's the topic of how you view and use your money. I want to talk to you today about accumulating wealth. And some of you are shocked by that I would say that, but you have in mind your bank account, and I do not. I'm not talking about your bank account. There are earthly possessions, and then there is eternal reward, and there is a connection between the two, but that connection is a little bit obscure, and I just want to illumine that this morning. What is that connection? I've titled this, Wealth to Go Home To. My objective statement is on the top of your sheet there. It's this. We should develop an understanding of what are real riches and live our lives to accumulate them. Don't waste your life on futile pursuits. Sometimes people get nervous when money is talked about in church. It's almost like, you know, there's conflict of interest here. I just want to assure you, I'm not paid a dime for pastoring here anyway, so you can throw that one right out the window. That's not the case here. It's not why I want to talk to you about this. But sometimes we have a feeling, you know, that money is an evil thing. I mean, doesn't the Bible say that money is the root of all sorts of evil? No, it doesn't. It says the love of money is the root. And that's this dilemma that we want to visit with about this morning. Money and earthly possessions and treasures are mentioned over 1,200 times in the Bible. I counted them. Actually, not individually, but you get the idea. I looked at treasures, I looked at money, I looked at jewels, and on and on and on. Over 1,200 times. It's a subject that God has no inhibitions talking about. Why should he? He made it. And he made it for good and for a good purpose. It's a good thing. It's not intrinsically evil to God, and it should not be to us either. But you know, somebody has complained that our money is tainted. It taint yours and it taint mine. That's what the saying, how the saying goes. Yeah. Well, I'd like to ask this morning if that's the case, whose is it? If it taint yours and it taint mine, whose is it? And you know the answer, but we're going to look at it this morning because I believe that the answer to that question is one of the most important things to solidify in our understanding of what God intends with our money. Whose is it? Let me take us back to the beginning of time here this morning. This is really fun for me. God created all things on earth in 6 days. On the last day, he made Adam, and a little later, he made Eve. They had plenty of food in the garden, but they were needy. They needed to eat. But they had plenty of food everywhere around them. They were never, ever anxious about what they were going to eat, about what they were going to drink, about what their future held. Never. Not until they sinned. They were eternally secure until that point. Then they disobeyed God, and God had warned them, and the day they would sin, they would die. And they disobeyed, and they died. They were tricked into abandoning the place of God's faithful provision in their lives wanting to be like God, and that would include wanting to provide for themselves. That wasn't going to work. One of the consequences of that death was a tremendous anxiety over survival. Isn't that something? They had been eternally secure, and now all of a sudden, here they were kicked out of the garden, and they were scared. Where's my next meal going to come from? God had he had cursed the labors of the man. It was going to be trouble now in his work. So fear became a consequence of disobedience, and fear had its own set of consequences from that day onward, and we are still in the throes of that to this day. Hoarding and stealing and envying are with us some 6,000 years later. These are things that fuel the American culture to this day. I really think that even a part of the Occupy crowd, part of them, are just there because they want what somebody else appears to have. They're not all that interested in justice and fairness. They just want what somebody else have. So envy has made it a crime for someone else to be successful, especially if it looks like they have more than you do. Envy has made that a crime. It goes way back to the garden in that first sin. We become scared. So fear has a consequence of disobedience, and envy is a consequence of the fear of not having enough, and that has led to further consequences. We have a tremendous fear of running out or not having enough. Always we have this fear, and that incites another list of sins. Everything from murder to selling drugs to prostitution, anything to make a fast buck, because we're scared. I'm insecure. I'm going to run out. If I can just gather enough money around me, maybe I can be secure. It's still with us today. The tremendous anxiety we can have over survival can make many of us focus on accumulating wealth here on earth and miss what Jesus called the true riches. So it's important for us this morning to start by answering that question. Whose is the wealth of the world anyway? You know the answer, but we're going to look at it anyway from Psalm 24, verse 1. It says, the earth is the Lord's, and everything in it, every tree, every blade of grass, every bird, every animal, every resource in the earth, it is all made by God, and it belongs to Him. It is His. And then it goes on and he says, the world and those who live in it, even the rich, God owns them. Mitt Romney supposedly has $250 million. Or does he? Is he not one of those who dwells on the earth? Then I would say that he only appears to have $250 million. Since God owns him, then the only sense in which Mitt owns all that money is in the sense that God has allowed him to play with it for a little while. That's all. When he dies, he'll leave it all here. Another psalm says it this way, and this is as if God is speaking, every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on 1,000 hills. I know every bird of the mountains and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you, for the world is mine and all it contains. That means that Warren Buffett, who would appear to own $39 billion, really doesn't own it. God owns him. And Jim Walton of Walmart fame, on paper, he's worth $21.1 billion. But at his death, he will be separated from it. It won't be his. It's not his. Oprah Winfrey has been granted $2.7 billion to play with for a while, but in the end, she'll leave it all. So it's not hers. You know, somebody has asked concerning a wealthy man who died. They asked him, how much money did he leave behind? And they got the right answer from the person they asked. The person said, all of it. He left it all. Doesn't matter how many dollars, he left it all. That's the right response to that question. He really did not possess it. We're only granted a time to do business with it. We want to look at a major passage concerning real riches in Matthew chapter 6. And as we do, I want to restate my objective this morning. Here it is again. it is that we would develop an understanding of what are true riches and live our lives to accumulate them. Matthew 6, you know, is part of the trio of chapters there, 5, 6, and 7. We call it the Sermon on the Mount. And there's one central theme running through the whole thing. There are a lot of different topics, but there is one central theme running through the whole sermon, and it's this. God sees you, and God rewards. That's the theme of the whole Sermon on the Mount. And so early in chapter 6, he says there are some hypocrites who are sounding the trumpets when they put money in the box. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And Jesus said, guys, that's all they're going to get. Just your little accolades, and then it's gone. And Jesus instructed his disciples, when you give, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, whichever that is. And your Father who sees in secret, he will reward you. And the implication is you get an eternal reward. So that's sort of the context of this section of verses we're going to look at in Matthew chapter 6. And we'll start in verse 19. Jesus said, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. So point number one is that earthly rewards and resources can fail. The dollar can fail tomorrow. Paul wrote Timothy about the rich in this present age. He said, instruct those who are rich in the present age not to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches. Conversely, heaven's rewards cannot fail. That's what Jesus said. Heaven's rewards cannot fail. If we learn to lay up treasures in heaven, and I'll get to some specifics on this morning, and then you'll have the rest of your life to live it out. There'll be opportunities daily. But whatever you have done by faith is an eternal, can you imagine that? Eternal reward that has your name on it. This is pretty significant. In other words, Jesus was warning his disciples of the fact that it is possible to misuse worldly wealth and to waste their lives. Jim Elliot, who lost his life witnessing to an Indian tribe or several of them down in Ecuador, he said, he's quoted as saying this, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. I mean, that makes sense. That makes logical sense. But you must think the truth if you're going to live that way, if you're going to receive the benefit of that. Jim understood this principle that true personal riches are those we intentionally exchange the stuff of this life for. We invest the stuff of this life and we gain something in eternity. Let's read on. Matthew 6, 21. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And I read it in the New American again. This one says, there your heart will be also. The NIV is a little different. Point number two. Our heart follows that which we elevate in importance. If we're drawn to that which may decay or be lost, we will grow discouraged as the time to leave it approaches. I'm going to leave it. I feel worse and worse and worse because pretty soon I'm going to leave my big accumulation here. But if we are drawn to that which has eternal value, we're drawn to hope, and our life takes on hope. If you knew good was coming, you would live that type of life. You can. You should. This is the life God is calling us to, not to waste it on things of this life. So let's go on. Matthew 6, 22. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is actually darkness, how great is that darkness? I mean, this is what you have to envision your life with. If your vision is dark, man, how bad is that? So what's he talking about here? Point number three is this. In Matthew 6, 22 and 23, the health of the lamp of the body is being evaluated by how we view our possessions, our earthly possessions. We can get tricked into viewing our earthly possessions as being the source of security and real living and end up wasting our lives. That would be having bad eyes. Or we can view our possessions simply as resources to use for eternal purposes, knowing that the soul's life comes from God's purposes on this earth. And that would be having good eyes. I see Mike here this morning. He certainly didn't know this. I didn't know this until I saw Mike. But about 25 years ago, one Sunday afternoon, Mike drove a car into our driveway and said, "It's yours." And it was a nice car. I think it was an 84 Cutlass, wasn't it? Is that about right? Yeah. And of course, our kids, we have five children, and our oldest, honestly, he's a very gregarious child, and he attempted to be the taxi of the town. And so he virtually wore that car out. But that gift is not done giving to Mike and Jenny. Again, we went over this last week with Adam and Sarah and their van. But God sees and he rewards. And Mike lost a vehicle, but he gained an eternal reward. God will forever be glorified by that act, that deed of service to me. It honored God. It helped us. That's worth remembering for eternity. So we're talking about having good eyes here. Suppose you want to win the lottery. Jesus would ask you, why? Don't you realize that you already have all you need in order to gain eternal rewards? You already have it. You'll gain much more by taking one little dollar, I won't get it out, one little dollar, and using it to advance the cause of righteousness or to win a friend for the kingdom than you could ever have by putting a few million dollars in your account. You know that's going to fail. You know that's not going to fail. If it's done by faith, if it's something that God led you to do, it'll be forever. That's having good eyes. I want to give you another illustration. Some of you know I do radon work. We call it mitigating radon situations. I install these tubes that pump out radon gas. And the tools that I have are fairly expensive. I have several tools that cost a couple hundred dollars a piece, several hundred dollars a piece. What would you think if I went down to my basement and built some shelves and a nice big display case and I lined up my tools and every day I went down there, oh, that's very nice. And when you came over to my house, I said, come here, I'll show you my tools. See? But I never used them. I never released anybody from the dangers of radon gas. What would you think? What? That is exactly how Jesus thinks when we look at our earthly possessions as if they have any intrinsic value in and of themselves. They were given to us in order to gain something, not in order to be something. Our view of our wealth is important. Matthew 6:24, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. So that's point number four. You cannot serve both God and money. You need to choose one. If you do not choose to serve God with everything you have, you'll serve money. And you'll short-circuit your rewards. You'll have your reward in full. It'll bring you a little bit of comfort. You can go out to eat maybe, or whatever, you know. Whatever you have, you can have a little warm fuzzy of over. But then it's over. Let's go on. Matthew 6:25. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you'll wear. Is not life more important than food and the body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the lilies of the field grow? They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that's how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? And this verse is very interesting, verse 31. Remember what we were talking about in the garden? Here it is, 4,000 years later, Jesus said, so don't worry, saying, what do we eat? What do we drink? What are we going to clothe ourselves with? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. And verse 33 is a really important verse in this discussion. In the NIV it says, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Point number 5 is this. Understanding real riches is about priorities. It's about priorities. This week I've been reading again of Joseph. And in Genesis, there Joseph was in Egypt, and the king had a dream, you know. He had two dreams of these 7 sleek cows and the 7 lean cows and the 7 plump heads of grain and the 7 lean stalks, you know. And Joseph said, well, this is what's going to happen. Famine. And what you need to do is to, in these rich years, take a fifth of your produce and set it aside. I bring this up because I'm not saying that we should give it all away. I'm not saying that that's all that there is to God's will, that you don't have anything. There are legitimate things that we know are coming. We should prepare for them. This is a scriptural thing. But the issue is priorities. The issue is your priorities. Jesus asks us first to use some of our resources that he's given us specifically for righteousness and his kingdom. Specifically for things that, you know, you don't have a way personally to affect. You need to take something that you have and put it into motion so that it can affect that. Seeking his kingdom would include contributing to this church. This church is made up of people that God's going to use to reach out more and more to people in this area. He wants us just to have a part in it. Giving some of the first of your paycheck to this church with that understanding. Now, here I am asking for money. Yeah, I get to this. It's going to result in you gaining personal, eternal riches. Is that a bad thing for me to ask of you? I want you to be rich eternally. I want God to be glorified in your life. These things would be yours forever, and they will last. And then there are a lot of, so that's kind of his kingdom. And then there are many areas of righteousness to take care of. One of them is providing for your own household. That's an issue of righteousness. Do it. Do it as unto him. Do it for the sake of his kingdom, for the sake of his righteousness. That's in 1 Timothy. Provide for your own family. Contributing to the needs of orphans and widows is one clear desire of God. He wants us to be involved with taking care of the unfortunate. That's what he's like. And if you get involved in that, with that mindset, you are making good use of that which you cannot keep. Using your money or your possessions sometimes just to ease tensions. You know, I'm thinking partly of 1 Corinthians 6, where there's some discord in the church, and they were going to a lawyer to solve, and Paul said, guys, that's a defeat already. Why not rather be wronged? And sometimes we can use our worldly resources just to settle it down, just, okay, I'll take it. Let's not complain about a few dollars, I'll take it. You can use your money that way, and it brings God honor. Seek these things first, and you will have real riches in heaven. Let's look at one more passage on this. It's actually a parable, and it's recorded in Luke 16. Jesus told his disciples this story. There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and he asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management because you cannot be manager any longer. The manager said to himself, oh, what should I do now? My master's taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, make it 400. Let's make it 400. Then he asked the second, and how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it's gone, or when you're gone from it, when it's gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will be dishonest with much. This is such a confusing parable that I just want to stop at this one little point and make a comment on this verse. Whoever can be trusted in the context of this, being trusted with it would mean using it for an eternal gain. Using it wisely. Whoever can be trusted with very little can be trusted with much. Verse 11, so if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you a property of your own? And here's this familiar verse repeated in this gospel. No servant can serve two masters. Either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. He cannot serve both God and money. Okay, there are a lot of things in this parable that sound awkward to our normal way of thinking. First of all, Jesus was not praising the manager's dishonesty. That wasn't the point of the parable. He was merely using the illustration to make the point that he was no fool who used what belonged to somebody else in order to gain something for himself. That's kind of a bright idea. In the story, the manager used what belonged to his master in order to make inroads into the lives of his master's debtors. You see the implication? If none of us owns anything, none of us owns anything, no man has anything but that it has been given to him from God, then using what I appear to have in my billfold to influence for the kingdom is a shrewd thing to do. You might get saved. For about a decade, 10, 12 years, my wife and I have been contributing to an organization called Gospel for Asia. And we have three missionaries that we have been supporting for these years. And who knows what it's going to be like in eternity? People are getting saved over there like flies. Who knows what sort of welcome there may be? Is that a glory to me? I just used what God gave me, invested it where I thought I could, and we will see eternal rewards. So the instruction in this little parable for us is to get our eyesight cleared up, to see worldly wealth does not belong to us, and it doesn't belong to anyone else either for that matter, but its value can be used to gain something that will be there for us when we arrive in heaven, something that is really ours. That's why I called the title of this, Wealth to Go Home To. I just like that. Wealth to go home to. It's there. Can't wait to get there. Wealth to go home to. Jesus has the master praising the manager for being shrewd. The manager provided for his retirement on earth by this little scheme of making friends. But for the believer, our real retirement won't be here, it'll be in heaven. And Jesus is merely saying that people in this world do a better job of looking forward to providing for the retirement than we do of looking forward in eternal sense, in eternal truth, not making this up, this is the reality, preparing for our eternity. Preparing for our eternity. We won't need earth's resources there, but we will appreciate every use of the things that do not really belong to us in order to gather a harvest for heaven. Every time I look at somebody in heaven that we had a part in their salvation, it'll be joy all over again. It'll never fade, 1 Peter says. It'll never fade. It's not like a trophy here on earth that gathers dust and rusts. It'll never fade. That's real, real, personal reward. So what are you investing in? What is your treasure? Maybe you think you have too little to give. Does it seem like every last penny you have, you need for your survival? I mean, come on, we're Americans. We have a little to give. We have a little. I'm not saying these things to get you to give. I am saying these things to encourage you to act on a true understanding of riches. Understand that ever since the fall of man, we've been anxious to protect our little possessions. I heard this story told this way once, that a dad went to Dairy Queen and he bought his daughter a nice little ice cream cone. He handed it to her and she was licking away, enjoying it completely. And then dad said, "Hey, can I have a lick?" And she says, "No, it's mine." He gave it to her, the whole thing. And she said, "No, it's mine. It's what we do." That's how far the fall kind of affects us. It affects our culture, and then we get imbibed in it. We kind of feel that way, like, I can't give. I won't have anything left. That's the way we feel. Understand where that comes from. And then understand that God is still wanting to be our provider, just like he wanted to be Adam and Eve's. And then understand that God is just asking us to exchange by faith some of our worldly possessions in order to gather some true heavenly real estate. I mean, it's real. It'll be our own. Don't be afraid to give to righteous causes. Don't be afraid to give to Lifehouse. This would be one of the ways you could seek first his kingdom. God's watching. Test him in it. He says all these things that you need will be provided for. From Matthew 6:33, all the things you need will be provided for you. We will joyfully hear your stories of how God provided. We hear them all the time. My family has been involved in at least three building campaigns down in Ames. And I'm honest with you, the first time that we were considering this, I felt like we had nothing to give. And I sat about as close as B is to me, to a guy who was speaking to us about giving making a faith pledge. I think that's what he called it. And I raised my head and said, "What is that?" And he's, you know, it's obvious, but I wanted to hear him try to explain it. Just you pray about it and you decide on a number and you say, "This is what I think God would have us to give." And I don't remember if I was still pretty scared of this, but we made some kind of pledge, and we did this several times. And then I started to keep track. I wrote down hundreds of things that God did to provide. That's another message, you understand. That's about God's faithfulness. This message is about your eternal rewards. But I do want to just remind you that this is the way your God is. And I would love to have a room full of stories. We have open mic, and we can't wait to get to the stage and tell, "You know, God did this. And this was hard for me, and God did this. This was hard for me, and God did this." It'll bring glory. But the greater thing is that you will have your own personal reward. Give as unto the Lord himself. Never mind Lifehouse. That doesn't matter. Give as the Lord leads you to give. Get involved in the process of gaining, accumulating eternal wealth. One more thing this morning. This is not about the amount or about comparison. It is about prayerfully using something that cannot last to lay up treasure for yourself in heaven. Give what you can, cheerfully and prayerfully. When my children were much younger, we had paper routes. And And of course, we were doing this, raising our family, while these building campaigns were going on down there in Ames at Stonebrook. And on one of the last ones, I don't know if it's the second or the third one, I thought, "I know, I'm going to coach my kids in this." They had income from the paper routes. And I went individually to them, and we discussed how much maybe they could contribute. And to them, it was a huge amount. It was over 100 for each one of them. I think $200, $300, $400, something like that, over a period of 3 years. And I split it out for them. This is how it would work out. And a few weeks ago, I was kind of cleaning out my files. I do this annually, you know, it's a new year. And I came across the little ditties that that Stonebrook gave each of our kids for the amount that they were pledging. Okay, this is your pledge reminder. Every one of them completed their gift. I wrote it down, the date that they did. Do you think Dad's happy with that? I am very, very pleased that they had this experience. How much more will our Heavenly Father be excited about a prayerful and honest decision to invest? Here's a need. I believe God would have me to provide. I do it, and He is honored. And we have an eternal reward. God knows your situation. He will be more moved by someone who has little to give but who gives than by someone who gives from his abundance. That's a principle. True riches are those that will be yours forever. That's true riches. My heart's desire for you is that you would become very wealthy eternally. May God just give us grace to live this out. Let's pray here. God, we thank you that everything is yours. Everything is yours. Every person is yours. Every person's assumed wealth is actually yours. And this is a big subject. And there's a lot of investigation that needs to go on in our hearts about where we're at with this. But I just ask you that you would impress upon us the simple truth that we have something that you have given us that we can give to righteousness in your kingdom. God, we long for you to be displayed in our little group of people here, our little family, that you would be honored, that you'd be the most shining one among us, the most famous one here, because you consistently show us your faithfulness. And it gives us confidence that our eternal reward is also coming. Paul prayed for the Ephesians that they'd have minds to be able to comprehend this kind of thing. We ask you for that. Help us to think in terms of eternal truth. In Jesus' name, amen.